Okay, welcome back, listeners, to the latest edition of Oklahoma Appeals, the podcast. Gabe Bass here with my venerable colleague, Jana Knott. Jana, how you doing today?
Doing okay. It's good. Friday.
It is Friday. I don't know what day you're listening to this, but for us, today is Friday. Okay, so a little bit of court news, and then we're going to cover three new published opinions from the Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals and a couple of published opinions from the Oklahoma Supreme Court. So I think we're going to do that in the reverse of what I just said. We're going to do the Supreme Court cases first. But even before that, Jana has a little bit of court news.
That's right. So Justice Keen was recently sworn in her official swearing in ceremony to the Oklahoma Supreme Court. And we also learned last week that Judge Pemberton, who was appointed to the Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals, I think about 2 years ago, is resigning from the Court of Civil Appeals to become the general counsel for Governor Stitt. So there will be yet another opening on the Court of Civil Appeals fairly soon.
All right. Well, very interesting development. Of course, we wish Judge Pemberton best wishes in his new role, and we'll miss his opinions. He was a fairly prolific writer of opinions on the Court of Civil Appeals. So
that's right.
We'll anxiously await the JNC process and the selection of his replacement. Okay, well then let's jump right into our new published opinions from our Oklahoma Civil Appellate Courts. And we have two new opinions from the Oklahoma Supreme Court since they have resumed conference after their summer break from conference. And the first case is Bayer versus the Mule, B-E-Y-E-R, 2021 OK-45. If you're an Oklahoma City resident, you're probably familiar with the Mule. That's a restaurant and bar down in the, what is that area called?
You know, I live in El Reno, so I'm not as hip as you. I can't tell you where the Mule's
That's in the the Plaza District.
Plaza, Paseo.
Yeah, they're close together.
Somewhere like that. Okay.
I'm not hip enough to spend much time in the Plaza, but I have been there and I'm familiar with the Mule. So what happened here? Well, the underlying case is that a woman who was a patron at the Mule fell and broke her hip and sued the restaurant on a premises liability claim in the trial court. And she lost following trial on a comparative negligence type situation. The jury assigned her, I think, something like 80% of the responsibility for the accident. So
yeah, 74%
negligent. 74% negligent. So she loses and the defendant wins. Then, after trial, the plaintiff files a motion for new trial and alleges juror misconduct. Mm-hmm. And the alleged juror misconduct was that one of the jurors, who happened to be the foreman of this jury, failed to disclose some prior litigation history during voir dire. And that's how I'm going to pronounce it. I know depending on where you're from, it's pronounced differently, but that's what we're going with here. So there were a couple of questions asked during voir dire about involvement in prior litigation. And it was the type of question, you know, has any juror been involved in a lawsuit? If you don't raise your hand, then there's no follow-up questions. So this particular juror was silent when questions were asked that perhaps could have elicited some information regarding the juror's prior litigation involvement. And the trial court, which is Oklahoma County, I should mention, this case comes up out of Oklahoma County. The trial court, Judge Timmons, did a bit of fact-finding on what exactly the nature of this juror's prior involvement in litigation was and said, hey, based on that, I don't think this was a problem. The involvement was minimal. Specifically, at the time of this prior lawsuit, this juror was the defendant, but they were a minor. It was a 2005 case. The case was filed and then settled. The juror, who again was a minor at the time, his father was the one who had all the interaction with the lawyers. And so it was settled shortly after filing. There was no economic detriment to this particular juror, so no reason that they should be particularly defense friendly just based on this interaction with, you know, the litigation system. So basically no big deal, not a substantial issue at all. The substantial rights of the defendant or the plaintiff in this case are not harmed by this juror's failure to disclose that 15-year-old case in which they were a very minor participant. So motion for new trial denied. Case goes up to Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals, and they actually reverse the trial court and say, well, you know, it's almost kind of like per se violation of the plaintiff's rights, because when the juror failed to disclose their involvement in this prior litigation, that deprived the plaintiff's lawyer of the right to, you know, ask follow-up questions and flesh out what this juror's opinion may have been about their involvement in litigation. And, you know, they may have unearthed some prejudice that would have been important. And they didn't have the chance to do that because the juror was silent and didn't disclose this. And so Court of Civil Appeals reverses. And they do so in a split decision, which is kind of unusual for the Court of Civil Appeals. We see a lot of 3-0 decisions from the panels. In this case, there was the opinion, one concurring, especially, and one dissent. And curiously, also, they published it, which is also a little bit strange from, or I guess unusual. I don't know if strange, but, you know, they don't publish very many of their decisions. And I don't remember seeing any other published opinions in the last couple of years since we've been doing the podcast where it was a split decision that the Court of Civil Appeals published. But nevertheless, they did it. And the plaintiff petitioned for cert. The Oklahoma Supreme Court granted cert and reversed the Court of Civil Appeals, unpublished the opinion or withdrew it from publication, and essentially affirmed the trial court's decision. The Oklahoma Supreme Court says, look, the trial court was within, you know, the law to inquire into the kind of nature and extent of this juror's involvement in prior litigation. And we agree that it wasn't very significant. The trial court was fine to examine the circumstances of this juror's litigation history, and they did not err when deciding that it wasn't worthy of a new trial. A little bit of interesting procedural tidbits. The reason we know the facts about this juror's 15-year-old involvement in a prior lawsuit was because the defendant submitted an affidavit to the trial court that explained the facts of their prior involvement in a lawsuit, as well as their understanding and interpretation of the questions that they were asked on voir dire. And the affidavit was not challenged, and so it becomes part of the record, and the Supreme Court says, look, we have to basically take these facts as true, and they weren't challenged in the trial court. And when the trial court's order doesn't have any findings of fact and conclusions of law, which it didn't in this case, the order denying the plaintiff's motion for new trial was just basically a summary type order of motion denied. And when we don't have any findings of fact and conclusions of law, any findings of fact that were necessary for the adjudication by the trial court of the motion are presumed. And so we're going to take those as the facts. And on those facts, no substantial or significant harm to the plaintiff. And the Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals opinion is withdrawn from publication, reversed, vacated in part, and trial court affirmed. It was vacated in part because there was an issue of cost that the trial court was reversed on as well. The trial court had awarded some cost in the case, and the Court of Civil Appeals reversed the award of cost. Apparently, neither party brought that up in the cert petition or response. So the Supreme Court doesn't disturb that finding or ruling of the Court of Civil Appeals. So technically they vacated the Court of Civil Appeals opinion in part because they did leave the reversal of the trial court's award of cost in place, but vacated the part that reversed the trial court's denial of the motion for new trial and overall just withdrew the case from publication. It was 9-0 at the Supreme Court. Opinion was authored by Justice Edmondson, and all the other justices concurred. It's a pretty lengthy opinion, which is common for those authored by Justice Edmondson. They do go into a great deal of detail about precedent. So there's a lengthy discussion of juror misconduct in the opinion, if you are so inclined.
There's also a discussion in the opinion about this issue of vacating in part and affirming in part an opinion from the Court of Civil Appeals. So procedurally, that's sort of an interesting issue. I would also note that the opinion from the Court of Civil Appeals, Judge Gorey issued a specially concurring opinion, and it's important to note that it was not concurring in result, but just specially concurring, because otherwise they would not have had the two votes to actually form a majority at the Court of Civil Appeals. So just a little tidbit for you. It has to be, can't be concurring in result, has to be specially concurring if he's going to write separately. So the other thing I think that is interesting about this case is that if I remember correctly, I think this is the first case since the Ledbetter decision that they issued in 2012 that discusses juror misconduct on a motion for new trial. So this is probably a case, even though it's kind of lengthy, it's probably a case that if you're a trial lawyer, you want to pull and take a look at it a little bit more closely, because we don't get these very often. So,
all right. What one other thing that I wanted to mention, which I just thought was kind of curious, the issue of the jurors' prior involvement in civil litigation, you know, didn't get raised by the plaintiff until after the trial in a motion for new trial. But if you just go to OSCN and search this particular juror's name, the 2005 case that became an issue is readily discoverable.
Interesting.
So certainly the plaintiff, you know, presumably as a part of your jury selection process, you would at least search the jurors' names in OSCN to see if they've been involved in any litigation. And if they would have done that in this case, it appears they would have found this case. So not sure if they knew about it and just let the issue lie, or if they truly didn't discover that the juror was not disclosing their prior litigation involvement until after the trial.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Next up, 2021, OK 52. This is Dopp versus Kirkendall. This case has been going on for a while. Oh, man. Okay. So Mr. Dopp is an inmate in the Oklahoma Department of Corrections, and his name appears on what is called the Oklahoma Registry of Frivolous or Malicious Appeals.
Not a list you want to be on.
Not a list you want to be on. If your name's on there three or more times, then you cannot proceed in filing a civil case as an inmate unless you have paid your filing fee or the court has granted your pauper's affidavit status. So,
but inclusion on this list will not necessarily prevent you from being granted cert.
This is true. Yes. We will talk about this in this case. So, this all started in 2012 when Mr. Dopp sent his petition against the Kirkendalls into Rogers County. And included with that was a motion for leave to proceed in forma pauperis. And the clerk did not immediately file the petition. And instead, the chief judge of Rogers County issued an order denying his motion to proceed and said that in the order said that Mr. Dobb had filed 14 civil lawsuits since 2002, 8 of which had been dismissed. Anyways, he technically wasn't on the list 3 times. The district courts or whatever court he's proceeding in actually has to make a finding that the filing is frivolous or malicious in order for you to get put on the list. So it wasn't technically correct. I mean, he probably had filed that many petitions, but he wasn't technically on the list in 2012 in any event. He files a writ in the Supreme Court and they issue the writ and they send it back and they tell the Rogers County court clerk that they have to file the petition when it's sent in. And then the district court has to make a decision on whether he can get pauper status, basically.
So the clerk just basically set the petition aside and said, we'll see what the judge says.
The law, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Supreme Court's been pretty intentional over the last, I would say, 5 to 8 years about making sure the district courts are filing these petitions and then making the district court judge that's in charge actually issue an order on pauper status instead of just, I mean, if you don't file it of record, then there's nothing for them to later appeal to challenge that. And that's kind of there's a case from 2006, I think, with an inmate, Robert Cotner, where this is all discussed. So anyway, so it gets the writ, it goes back down, and there's no decision ever made on his pauper status and whether he should be paying a filing fee or whether he can proceed as a pauper. The case is transferred to a different judge, and then it proceeds in litigation for something like 4 years before the attorneys for the defendants realize that this guy's now on the frivolous filing list. And so they file, I think they file a motion to dismiss, and that was eventually granted by the district court for his failure to pay the filing fee. Within 10 days of that dismissal order, Mr. Dopp files a motion to reconsider, and that's denied.
Which is really just a motion for new trial, right?
Yes.
There is no such thing as a motion to reconsider as technically in Title 12. That's a creation of lawyers and
inmates, apparently.
Inmates. Plenty of lawyers file them too.
That's right. Okay. So the motion to reconsider, AKA motion for new trial, is denied. And so Mr. Dopp then appeals that order. He does not pay a filing fee for his appeal. And so the Supreme Court issues a show cause order and tells him either pay the filing fee or show us that you are a pauper in order to allow this appeal to proceed. He never makes the payment. And so the court dismisses the appeal and the mandate issues April 25th, 2018. He then refiles his petition in the district court on August the 9th of 2018. And this time he does pay the filing fees. And it's assigned again to, I don't know if it's the same judge. I think it is. Yeah, it's the same judge. And so the other side then files another motion to dismiss, saying that he was outside of the 1-year savings statute and that his 1 year began to run from the trial court's dismissal order that then he appealed. So he argues then in the response that, look, I appealed that order and it wasn't final until 2018. I'm well within the 100 days to refile this. Nevertheless, the trial court disagrees with him and says, no, the 1-year saving statute started to run when the lower court entered its dismissal. Mr. Dopp then appeals that. He pays his required cost deposit for the appeal, and so his appeal is allowed to proceed. It's assigned to the Court of Civil Appeals, and the Court of Civil Appeals affirms the trial judge's ruling. And Mr. Dopp files his first cert petition with the Oklahoma Supreme Court. The court grants the cert petition and says, Court of Civil Appeals, we would like you to reconsider this case and please consider Cole versus Josie, which was decided in 2019, and Grider versus USX Corporation, which was decided in 1993. The Court of Civil Appeals obliges and considers that precedent, distinguishes it, and issues another opinion 3 weeks later, affirming the trial judge again. Mr. Dopp files a second petition for cert. The court grants that second petition for cert yet again and takes the case. And this is what now we have an opinion on.
Okay.
Okay. So the court basically says, look, just because the inmate is on the frivolous filing list, if he pays his filing fee or the court finds that he's a pauper, then it basically proceeds just as if he was any other litigant. And so when the trial court dismissed his case originally and he filed that motion to reconsider, he told his time to appeal just like any other litigant would. The appeal then told the one-year saving statute, and that statute did not begin to run until the appeal was final. And so his second petition that he refiled was within the one-year saving statute, and it should not have been dismissed. So that's it. They send it back and allow the case to proceed after all of that. They look at Cole and Grider, which they'd ask the Court of Civil Appeals to look at, and say there's no way to distinguish them here. So
interesting.
That's it. I mean, I would say that maybe this is a case you look at, you know, to see if there's anything interesting about the savings statute here, but it really is pretty focused on, you know, this statute in Title 57, which includes the frivolous filing registry. So I'm not sure, you know, maybe it has some applicability outside of that. In my view, the savings statute case law is pretty clear and has been established as far as when your time runs, if there's an appeal filed. But anyways, there may be some nuggets in here of interest with regard to the savings statute. Anyone's interested.
But probably primarily of interest to our trial judiciary listeners.
That's probably right.
And how to handle petitions from inmates and and the pauper affidavits and all that stuff. So, of course, inquiring minds probably want to know, what is Mr. Dopp all worked up about? And who is this guy? And well, so, you know, I'm just here to report the news. And apparently, Mr. Dopp is serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole under three strikes rules. His final conviction was in 1996 on some drug charges, including felon in possession of a firearm, trafficking, maintaining a residence for the use of controlled substances, and was sentenced in 1998 under our three strikes rules to life without the possibility of parole. But he is suing somebody, ironically, for replevin of some firearms.
holding onto his property for too long or something to that effect.
Yes.
So.
Apparently, according to Mr. Dopp, he made a binding contractual agreement to provide storage free of any and all charge for some of his firearms. And the folks who were in possession of them, I guess, didn't honor his alleged agreement and perhaps sold them or kept them or something. So he's suing those people for replevin, conversion, breach of contract, bailment, fraud or constructive fraud, conspiracy, defamation of character, and negligence.
That's right. And I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, we are here to report the news, but also, you know, that's a lot of nuggets that are buried in the footnote in this opinion, and somebody wrote those. And so, you know, we're just, you know, highlighting that hard work.
That's right.
In creating those footnotes. So it's tough. They work hard on that. And so we're here to just say kudos for your work on giving us all those nuggets.
Hey, we don't just care about, you know, the procedure. We want the human side of the story too.
That's right.
This episode is brought to you by OklahomaForms.com. Take cut and paste to the next level with hundreds of automated forms in multiple practice areas. Draft better documents faster and make your practice more efficient and profitable for only $49 per month. No long-term commitment. Cancel any time. Join hundreds of Oklahoma lawyers that have already discovered the magic of OklahomaForms.com. Go to OklahomaForms.com to sign up for a free 7-day trial.
Okay, well, that brings you up to date on published opinions of the substantive nature from our Oklahoma Supreme Court for the last couple of months. So moving on now to the prolific Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals and their new published opinions. I think you have the first one of those. See, we've got three to cover. Two of them are yours. One of them is mine. I'm getting off easy this episode.
And you are prolific in that the Court of Civil Appeals continues to crank them out. So here we are again with another update.
Yeah, and these are just the published ones.
The published ones, that's right. We get an alert just about every day of new unpublished opinions coming from the Court of Civil Appeals. So
they're workhorses.
That's right. Okay, so the first opinion is Parisa versus John E. Barbary Trust, 2021 OK Civ App 36. And this is a case coming to us from the District Court of Tulsa County. And this case also has a fairly long litigation history that I won't get into. I think the nuts and bolts of it are this is an alleged breach of an assumption of lease agreement, and it stems from a ruling in a prior condemnation action where the city of Tulsa condemned the property. And then this Mr. Morad, who is associated with the plaintiff's company, files a new lawsuit and asserts fraud in the initial petition, and then files an amended petition to assert claims for breach of contract under this lease agreement, promissory estoppel, and breach of warranties. And so if you're really interested in how all of this gets up on appeal, you can go check out the opinion. But at the end of the day, what this case comes down to is summary judgment and whether or not there's a fact question on this assumption of lease agreement. And so the trial judge grants summary judgment in favor of this trust, and Mr. Morad appeals. And the Court of Civil Appeals basically says, you know, when you have some kind of a contract like this, a lease agreement, you've got to have a meeting of the minds with respect to formation, whether there's an enforceable contract. And they say there's a question of fact in this case with regard to whether there was a meeting of the minds, mutual consent. Mutual mistake of fact is an element that a court can rescind a contract and restore the parties to the same positions as they were in when this was executed. So again, questions of fact, the court's sending it back. They also say whether the assumption of lease agreement was breached is inextricably intertwined with the issue of whether the agreement can actually be enforced. And so also sending that back to be resolved by the trial court. Damages also highly contested, has to go back. They do affirm in part here the promissory estoppel claim. They basically say, look, if there was a written agreement here, then he doesn't have any rights under a promissory estoppel theory, which the court had already disposed of on summary judgment. So affirmed in part, reversed in part, and remanded for further proceedings. And this is an opinion from Judge Prince with Judge Gorey and Judge Mitchell concurring. No cert petition filed. I would not be surprised if we don't see this up again on appeal in another year or two once this sorts out a little bit more. So again, a long history in this case. If you're interested in digging into what facts were disputed and why this is going back, you can go take a look at the opinion.
Yeah. Any insight as to why they may have published this one?
Nope. Yeah, got nothing.
I know. I was kind of curious to me as well, but they did. So
they did published opinion. Yeah. So
now usually they reserve their published opinions for announcing new law or applying law to new issue. I just didn't see in this one kind of what the hook was for for justifying a published opinion, but it's okay. It gives us more to talk about on the podcast.
That's right. That's right. More discussion for the pod. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, then moving on to the next case, Swinney versus Villanueva, 2021 OK Civ App 37. another published opinion from the Court of Civil Appeals, also coming up from the District Court of Tulsa County. And this one is of particular interest to our family law practitioners out there, as the court again takes a look at the applicability of the Gibbons test when it comes to modifying custody and visitation orders. You may remember that the Court of Civil Appeals took a look at the applicability of Gibbons in a visitation schedule modification case just late last year in Robinson v. Robinson, which was 2020 OK Civ App 68. So they're again kind of firming up the boundaries on the Gibbons test here in this case. So in that case, in 2020 in Robinson, they said that the Gibbons test doesn't apply when the father was just seeking relatively minor modification to a visitation schedule in connection with his good faith relocation, which rendered the prior visitation schedule impracticable. So Gibbons doesn't apply to that. So what is Gibbons, you ask? Gibbons is a 1968 case from our Oklahoma Supreme Court that deals with the burden of proof when a parent seeks to modify a child custody order. And essentially, I think in order to discourage parents who maybe don't have a custody order that they like from constantly seeking modification of it, the court set a pretty high bar on the parent asking that custody be changed. And they put the burden of proof on the parent seeking the change and said that they must show that since the making of the order sought to be modified, there has been a permanent, substantial, material change of conditions which directly affect the best interest of the child, and that as a result of such change in conditions, the minor child would be substantially better off with respect to its temporal and its mental and moral welfare if the requested change in custody be ordered. So pretty high bar to meet for a parent seeking to modify custody under the Gibbons standard. And again, it's been around a long time. It's 1968 case. Well, in this case, it wasn't necessarily custody that was being modified or that the applicant was seeking to modify, but a visitation condition. These parties were divorced in 2016. And at the time of the divorce, the trial court made a pretty extensive record of the concerns they had about the father's living conditions and, you know, suitability for visitation and required supervised visitation. So going back to 2016, the father has had supervised visitation. Well, even within a few weeks of trial, the father had sought modification of the visitation and asked that it be changed to unsupervised. And basically 4 years of litigation later, we finally end up with a two-day trial that's held in early 2020. And in that trial, the court denied the father's request for unsupervised visitation and said that the father did not sustain his burden of proof under the Gibbons standard. So the court's applying the Gibbons test here to the father's request to change visitation from supervised to unsupervised. The father appeals and the Court of Civil Appeals says, no, Gibbons test is not applicable to a change in a visitation from supervised to unsupervised. So again, they are kind of drawing a box around what the Gibbons test applies to. And we now know that under these facts anyway, it doesn't apply to a request to change visitation from supervised to unsupervised. So they remand the case back and we'll see what happens when the trial court applies a less stringent test than the Gibbons test to the father's request to modify visitation. It's a 3-0 decision from the Court of Civil Appeals authored by Judge Prince, Judge Gorey, and Mitchell concurring.
Okay. I feel like you're going to be the pod's resident expert on the Gibbons test. So I will gladly allow you that position.
Well, it has to do with burdens of proof. Yeah. So this is normally something that's kind of in your wheelhouse, but just happens to be that I think the two times we've had published opinions addressing the Gibbons test, they've both been cases that I somehow ended up with. So
okay,
we got Robinson and we got 2020 versus Villanueva. Robinson again from late 2020. That's all I got on that.
Okay. Next up, 2021 OK CivApp 38, Hayes versus Logisticare Solutions. This is a case coming out of the District Court of Rogers County. So Rogers County is prolific in today's episode. This involves Sooner Ride, which is a statewide non-emergency transportation benefit that's available to Sooner Care members. And in 2018, the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority awarded the defendant Logisticare a contract to administer the Sooner Ride program on its behalf. And so in the Sooner Care program, participants can request transportation through Logisticare, and then Logisticare assigns the transportation job to a local third-party provider. The local third-party provider at issue in this case is Morgan Medical. And so Ms. Moyer requested the transportation service and in February of 2018, and she was being transported at the time by one of Morgan Medical's drivers, Mr. DeCamp. And Mr. DeCamp allegedly drove the vehicle without ensuring that Ms. Moyer was belted into her wheelchair. And so during the trip, the driver braked suddenly, causing Ms. Moyer to fall out of her chair and break her leg. He then transported her to the hospital, where she ended up passing away 30 days later due to respiratory failure and pneumonia with other multiple contributing factors. So the plaintiff in this case, Hayes, is actually the special administrator of Ms. Moyer's estate and brought an action against the driver, Mr. DeCamp, Morgan Medical, his employer, and Logisticare, seeking recovery for Ms. Moyer's wrongful death. And the petition in this case listed three alternative theories of liability against Logisticare. They say Logisticare was liable because Morgan Medical and Mr. DeCamp were its agents. They also claimed that Logisticare was liable for its negligence in hiring Morgan Medical. And then finally, Logisticare was liable because the work performed was inherently dangerous. The parties filed competing summary judgment motions, and the trial court granted summary judgment to Logisticare. So this is up on summary judgment, and so the standard of review is de novo. And the Court of Civil Appeals, in a 3-0 opinion, affirms in part and reverses in part, and finds that the court erred in granting summary judgment to Logisticare on Hayes's alternative theory that even if Morgan Medical is an independent contractor, Logisticare is responsible for its actions because the work is inherently dangerous. Now, stay with me here. Under this doctrine, the employer engaged in an inherently dangerous activity has a duty to anticipate and guard against events which may reasonably be expected to occur because of the inherently dangerous nature of the industry, and they cannot avoid liability for breach of this duty by delegating it to an independent contractor. The Court of Civil Appeals here says that the trial court incompletely framed this issue, and the inherently dangerous activity doctrine is sufficiently comprehensive to include not only work from which its description is inherently or intrinsically dangerous, and here's the key to this opinion, but also work which will, in the ordinary course of events, cause injury to others if certain precautions are omitted, but which may, as a general rule, be executed with safety if those precautions are taken. And so the court says, look, transporting Medicaid patients to their appointments may not be inherently or intrinsically dangerous. However, the trial court has to also consider whether the risk that physical injury to a wheelchair patient would occur in the ordinary course of events if seatbelt precautions are omitted. So, Court of Appeals finds that the trial court erred by failing to consider the second kind of inherently dangerous activity, that is, work which creates a peculiar risk of physical harm if special precautions are not taken. No cert petition filed. Headed back down.
Okay, so...
plaintiff's lawyers rejoice.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking. I mean, many activities could be inherently dangerous if you don't take precautions.
Precautions. I mean, seat belts for wheelchair patients. What about car seats for children? You know, yeah. Are they buckled in properly? All of those things. So interesting. I think there's a lot of language in here that you might want to take a look at and see if there's anything that can apply outside of this fact pattern.
Inherently dangerous activities, I think of as activities that no matter what precautions you take, they're still potentially dangerous. So right. Expanding an inherently dangerous activity to include activities that are safe if you take special precautions seems to really open the door to a lot of other things becoming inherently dangerous.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's a fair point.
Okay. Fair point. Well, we'll see. Not going to get anything out of the Oklahoma Supreme Court on it, of course, this time around, because no petition for cert sought, but could result in a Oklahoma Supreme Court opinion sometime in the near future, because relying on this Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals opinion, plaintiffs are likely to survive summary judgment in some situations that maybe we'll get this case back up and let the Supreme Court weigh in on it. Okay, well, I think that brings us to the end of all the published opinions that are available as of the time we record this. So you're up to speed and be on the lookout for those case alerts to hear about the next published opinions and get a little summary. So if you're not familiar with case alerts, then go over to oklahomaappeals.com and sign up to receive those by email. Those are semi-regular emails that we send out with brief summaries of the most recently published opinions from the Oklahoma Supreme Court and the Court of Civil Appeals, so you can stay on top of what's going on until we talk about them on the show. Okay, Jana, you want to give us a little preview of what our listeners can look forward to in the coming weeks?
Sure. So we've got a couple of guests coming up here in the next month or so that we are excited to have on. We are going to be having Mike Fields on, who's the district attorney for Canadian County and all of the counties in that district. I can't sit here and name them all, but anyways, he's going to come on here in a couple of weeks and visit with us about Cardinal Point, which is a new facility here in Canadian County that is similar to the Palomar facility in Oklahoma City. And so we're looking forward to that. And we also are going to be having Judge Fisher on the show here in about a month or so from the Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals. So we're excited to hear from him, learn a little bit about his career. And we see opinions from him all the time and talk about him. So hopefully he's not aggrieved by any comments we have made. So
okay. Well, great. Well, if you have things you would like us to ask District Attorney Mike Fields or Judge Fisher about, then let us know. Go over to the website and you can find a contact form there. You can also find email addresses for Jana and me. So let us know what you would like us to ask those two guests about and we'll try to work that in.
You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Oklahoma Appeals. So send us a message on there if you follow us and if you've got questions for our guests.
Perfect. Okay, Jana. Until next time, bye-bye.
Hi, everyone. This is Gabe again. To find show notes, contact the host, and more, go to oklahomaappeals.com. Also, if you're interested in the things we cover on this show, then you should follow us on Twitter at Oklahoma Appeals, where we post court news and other items of interest for Oklahoma lawyers. Okay, Jana and I will be back with a new episode every other Wednesday. So until next time, bye-bye.
This episode is brought to you by oklahomaforms.com. Take cut and paste to the next level with hundreds of automated forms in multiple practice areas. Draft better documents faster and make your practice more efficient and profitable for only $49 per month. No long-term commitment. Cancel any time. Join hundreds of Oklahoma lawyers that have already discovered the magic of OklahomaForms.com. Go to OklahomaForms.com to sign up for a free 7-day trial.